This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. This is the third tape in the series. All right, folks, first, a little bit of background. Piece number one of background. When you're looking at the story of Judah and Tamar, what do you want to figure out? What is the main issue that strikes you that you need to figure out? So, again, I think when you deal with this issue, you've got to come back to this distinction, which I try to make fairly often. So if you've heard this a lot from me, bear with me and try not to roll your eyes. And that is that you've got to distinguish between what bothers you and what bothers the text. You know, when you're dealing with the story of Jonah, and you have the problem, how could Jonah survive in the whale for 3 days? I mean, this is ridiculous. It's crazy that you expect me to believe in miracles. This is not a textual problem. This is your baggage, right? You have problems. If you read, for example, the Genesis, A Living Conversation by Bill Moyers, right? It's full of these kinds of questions. Questions which really, I think, don't bother the text, but bother us. We're 20th century humans, so we project our baggage on the text. You know, some guy comes along in this discussion and says, you know what the problem with Abraham is? The problem with Abraham is he didn't play enough basketball with Isaac. If he only played more basketball with Isaac, we never would have had these problems with the Akedah that he would have taken him up to sacrifice him at the top of the altar. You know, so what's going on? This guy didn't play enough basketball with his own kids, you know, so you can project that on the Bible. So I think, again, when you're looking at the story of Judah and Tamar, you've got to distinguish between your problems and the problems of the text. And what I would argue is that all too often, when you look at the story of Judah and Tamar, what's the first thing? You know, if you did a Rorschach, what do you call this again? I never can pronounce it. The Rorschach test. Rorschach. If you do a Rorschach test, you ask people who know the story of Judah and Tamar, what do you free associate with Judah and Tamar? What do you free associate? Scandal, you know, with a capital S. The story is seduction, where this woman dresses up as a harlot and seduces this great scion of the Jewish people dynasty, and he consorts with her, and we're privy to the private sort of sordid details of what he promises her and what she takes, and he's going to kill her afterwards. I mean, it's this whole, it seems like a soap opera. And then and the one question which bothers the modern mind, especially, by the way, the religious mind, right, is that when you look at this, you think, what in blazes is going on? You know, Yehuda, you know, we look up to Yehuda, he's the father of one of these tribes, and yet here he is, he's consorting with this harlot. How is it that we understand that? Now, let's pull back. Is that a textual question or not? Is the text bothered with that question? I hate to tell you, but if you read the text does not seem to be especially troubled by that. Why? We can philosophize about it. Why? But that's the fact. That's not the center of gravity of this story. Maybe once you're done with understanding the story on its own terms and you come back, and I think we can, by the way, we can deal with that question. And perhaps we can deal with it effectively. But it's not the same thing as being the text question. Let me give you another example of this. Back to the Akedah, right? Binding of Isaac. Binding of Isaac. What's the modern problem we all have with the binding of Isaac? You know, how could God do this? You know, how could God command somebody to take their child and sacrifice on the top of the mountain? It seems so awful. How could Abraham have listened? Maybe he should have just said no. So if you look at much of modern scholarship on this story, everyone's struggling with this question. They try to find answers to it in the text. But the scary fact of the matter is that if you read the text is not concerned with that question. It doesn't care less about that question. So we're very incensed by this, because how could the text not care about my question? But the fact is that the text is not designed to, it's not dealing with that question. Now, it may be that once you're done with analyzing the text in its own terms, you can then come back and say, okay, so why wasn't the text interested in my question? And then you can come to an answer to that, and that's possible. I think we need to do the same thing with Yehuda and Tamar. Maybe we have these issues. How could Yehuda have done that? But we really got to look at the story in its own terms and put that on the back burner, because I don't think that's the forefront concern of the text. When we're done with it, maybe we can revisit that question and say, okay, so why wasn't the text concerned with that? And then that's a legitimate inquiry. But let's try to figure out what the text is concerned with. And I think that may help us understand why it's not concerned with that. But I don't think it's concerned with that. So that's not going to be our prime focus. Prime focus is going to be trying to look at the text on its own terms. In order to do that, there is one little background piece of information which you have to know. You probably know it already because I must have mentioned it over the course of the past year. But as a little refresher course, one of the basic halachic concepts which the reader needs to know walking into the story of Yehuda and Tamar, or else you will have no idea what's going on in the story, is the concept of Yibum, of Levirate marriage. If you don't understand the concept of Yibum, Levirate marriage, you might as well just close the book now and go home, because there's no way you can understand the dynamics of what's happening in the story. Basically, very briefly, just quickly review, the idea of Yibum is, Yibum is a law which exists in the Torah. This law only existed in a formal legal sense once the Torah was given, but it seems clear from the story of Yehuda and Tamar that biblical personalities were aware of the concept of Yibum even before it was formalized into a law. That's the way the Ramban puts it. Nachmanides argues that the sod of Yibum, the secret of Yibum, is active in this story. So even though Yibum is not operating on a halachic level, and it's not, because the halachic strictures of Yibum would not be what's happening here, but nevertheless, a sort of extended example of Yibum, of Levirate marriage, is going on here. And so it seems clear that everyone understood these dynamics, and the Ramban sort of enunciates here, the Nachmanides, the sort of spiritual dynamics of Yibum, which the characters were aware of, which later on became formalized in the law of Yibum when the Torah was given. What is the law of Yibum? It is very simply the following. And again, the law sort of strikes a deaf ear to the modern American mind, so you have to get out of your modern American shoes and transport yourself back into this world. But basically the idea is the following. When a man and woman are married, and the husband predeceases the wife, and the man dies, and the family is childless, they have literally no child, no male child, no girl child, at that point, the mitzvah of Yibum suggests that it is a mitzvah, it is a positive commandment for a brother of the deceased to marry the widow, okay? And in so doing, to perpetuate his name. What is the purpose of this? The purpose of this is that he will marry the widow, and the child that they have will become the child, so to speak, of the deceased. This is an example of what we might call surrogate fatherhood. And the Torah takes this quite seriously. In other words, the child becomes the heir of the deceased, not the heir of the actual brother. And interestingly, to create Yibum, the man does not need to give the woman a ring. Right? In other words, when the man decides to, if the man and woman decide to marry, he doesn't need to give her a ring, the brother. Why not? There's no formal act of marriage. Why? Why is there no formal act of marriage?
Because
the answer is it's not their marriage. The answer is the brother is literally stepping into the shoes of his deceased brother, and all he's doing is revitalizing the marriage that once existed. It's literally it's sort of this surrogate fatherhood. If the story of Hagar and Ishmael is a story of surrogate motherhood, this is a story of surrogate fatherhood. So, for example, what happens, for example, before Yibum is performed? When a man marries a woman, they are childless, he dies, and before the brother then marries the woman is known halachically as what's called a shamerat yavam, which means a woman awaiting yibum. Now, what is the law of a woman? I'm just going to tell you what the halachic expression of this is. The halachic expression is that a woman who's a shamerat yavam is not allowed to marry any other man unless she first marries the husband and divorces. Now, what happens if they decide they don't want to get married? So they're not required to get married, although it's seen as a great act of loyalty to the deceased husband for them to do so. But if they choose not to get married, there is an escape clause. The escape clause is known as chalitza. Chalitza is a process by which, and we do this even nowadays. Nowadays, we no longer do yibum, but we do chalitza. And chalitza is the escape clause. It's a process involving, actually, the disgracing of the brother who chooses not to marry the widow for not agreeing to become involved in the surrogate fatherhood situation. There's this whole ceremony. She takes off a shoe, spits. I mean, it's a whole thing, right? But it's a sort of a disgracing of it. This is what you do to a man who won't build the house of his brother's home. But it is an escape clause of how they can terminate this relationship. But unless Yibum or Chalitza has been performed, if Yibum has been performed, what has happened is that the previous marriage has been re-enlivened, right? In other words, it's almost like the marriage is in limbo. Normally speaking, the way the halachic conception seems to be, normally speaking, marriage terminates with the death of the husband, okay? With divorce or the death of the husband. There is an exception to that. The exception to that is when there's no children. When there's no children, the marriage does not terminate with the death of the husband. Instead, the marriage goes into a state of limbo with the death of the husband. At that point, the marriage will then either become re-actualized through the marriage of the brother, in which the previous marriage is re-actualized, or will become terminated through chalitza, and chalitza would be the termination, at which point she would be free to marry. Now, what would happen if a woman would decide that she's not interested in any of this, and she decides she doesn't want to marry this brother, she's not going to wait for chalitza, she's going to go marry Joe, some other guy, even before chalitza and before Yibum. Okay? If she would do that, she would transgress a positive commandment, which is to marry this brother, but there would be no other consequences to her act. In other words, the child from her new marriage is not illegitimate, they're married, it's not considered adultery, that's that. However, that is the halachic expression of Yibum. Okay? It seems from the story of Yehuda and Tamar that before the halacha was codified with the giving of the Torah, when the concept of Yibum was in the air, that people considered a Shamerat Yavam as still married and would consider an act of intimacy with another man in that state of her being a Shamerat Yavam as tantamount to adultery, because the marriage with her previous husband has not been terminated. Again, that is not halachically true, but this was before halacha, and it seems from the story of Yehuda and Tamar, in that day and age, that's the way it was seen. Okay, that's the background that you need to know for this story. You also need to know, that, in order to really understand this story, that you have to understand how difficult it was. And see, nowadays when we do chalitza, we do it as a performance kind of thing. Nobody really thinks about it much. The hairs in our skin kind of bristle with the humiliation aspect of it, because it seems weird and strange. But nobody really gives it much thought. But if you transport yourself back and you think about the significance of what's really happening about in Yibum, you really understand what's happening, you realize what a difficult thing it really is to do. Right? Because if you think about it, you think, all right, so what's the big deal? All right, so I'd rather marry someone else, but I marry her, all right, fine. But you figure that if they like each other, the man, you know, so then they're fine, so they'll build a nice household and you make a party for them and you go home. But if you really understand what's happening in Yibum, you'll realize that it is not so simple. It's not so simple for the woman, and it's not so simple for the man. It's not so simple for the woman because what she's doing is, instead of going on with her life and marrying someone else, what she's doing is she's really dedicating her life at this point to the perpetuation of her husband's memory. The idea is that the man's line would be lost if it was not perpetuated through the marriage of the brother. It's difficult for the man because he's engaging in a surrogate fatherhood situation. Let me just pull back for one second to try to emphasize the real difficulty and the real sacrifice, I think, on both sides of the coin. I think I made this point once before when we were talking about, in the aftermath of 9/11, when I talked about this. But let me just revisit this for a second. I talked then about the strange notion that why men are called Zacharim. In other words, the name for a male in Hebrew is a Zachar. A zachar is a very strange thing. What?
Remember.
Right, because a zachar really means it's from zecher, to remember, which is a strange way of talking about men, because it has nothing. You know, it's defining maleness as remembrance. Now, that's a very strange way to define maleness. I mean, there's no reference to anatomy, the sort of sexual anatomy which would distinguish male and female, or what is that? Why speak of men as rememberers? So as I said before, you know, men don't have especially good memory. I don't have a great memory. So does that mean my masculinity is in peril because my wife remembers things better than I do? I mean, what does it mean to call men those who remember? So the argument that I made then, and I'd like to reassert, is that it really has to do with, again, reproduction. Now, the fundamental difference between male and female is that these are terms which involve reproduction. And it is, I think, defining the male focus on reproduction as a function of remembrance. In other words, if you ask men why they have children, and you ask women why they have children, I think you'll get vastly different answers by and large. Everyone's got a different agenda here, right? You ask women why they have children. Why is it significant to have children? So women will tell you, by and large, what will they tell you? They'll tell you because, you know, it's a miracle to create life. It's a great privilege to be able to nurture a child and to allow it to become what it'll become and to devote yourself towards creating this whole new world that's going to eventually strike out on as a path and become themselves. And that, I don't know, I mean, that's what I hear from women, right? Men will tend to see things, and if you ask 100 men, why is it, what's significant about having children, one of the things they will say is remembrance. What they will say is, what's significant about that, is that this is a child to carry on the family name. This is a child that is going to live in my footsteps. this is going to be a child that I'm going to teach, I'm going to raise, that is going to exemplify the family, is going to exemplify me. I'm going to transmit my values to this child. It's very much about keeping themselves alive in the world, right? What? Mini-me. That's right. It's a very me-centered thing. For a woman, it's a very non-me-centered thing. It's a very selfless thing. In other words, the female experience of childbirth is, in essence, selfless. In other words, even if you look at it, by the way, in terms of the act of conception, from the female standpoint, is a selfless act, right? In other words, what does the womb do? The womb acts as the quintessentially selfless organ, which is that the womb is very good at nurturing a child. We've never come up with an artificial womb yet, right? With all of our brilliance, all of our sophistication, we can have test tube babies, but nobody's ever come up with an artificial womb that you can have, that, you know, from month one to month seven or month five, that you can, you just can't take a baby through artificially. Now you say, okay, so what does the womb do that's so brilliant during this time? But what does the womb do? What the womb does, it feeds the child, offers a nice pH balance for the child. It offers a perfectly calibrated biochemical atmosphere at every stage of development for the child to develop. So if you think about it, the womb does, you can make the argument, at least from the masculine point of view, that the womb doesn't do anything. What does the womb do? I mean, all it is, the child's developing. The womb, what's the womb? Providing a space, a warehouse for the child to develop in? Or what's the big deal? You know, right? A sanctuary for the child to develop. But it's a very hands-off kind of experience, the womb. In other words, the womb does not impose its vision on the child. The DNA is the vision of the child, and the DNA is in the child. What the womb's mission is to allow the DNA of the child to become the child. Except the DNA of the child can't become the child unless the atmosphere is perfectly calibrated to what the child needs at every point to become itself. Right? So the experience of wombness, or of compassion, rahmanut, derived from rahem, of compassion, is to allow something to become what it's going to become, and to give it the environment and to nurture it to allow it to become what it's going to become. That is very different from a masculine perspective. It's a very hands-off perspective. Masculine perspective is much more about impact. I think that it has to do with men's preoccupation with death. Right? This is a whole other schmooze, but I think that when you realize, when mortality is something that weighs upon your mind, so when fear of death is something that animates your being, you become very preoccupied with trying to make sure that you can leave your impact in the world. Because I had to find some way to be remembered, some way to pass my legacy on so that death will not have the final say. When I know that annihilation is only around the corner, so then I need to preserve myself somehow, to find a way to preserve myself. Even at the moment of conception, right, the egg lives past conception and becomes what it becomes. Sperm dies and evaporates at the moment of conception. It leaves its impact upon the egg, and that impact changes the egg and makes it into something else. That in itself is a quintessential act of remembrance. In the moment of annihilation, to leave your impact upon something. That is what it means for Zecher. We talked about it in terms of Amalek, by the way, that this was what Amalek was about, that Amalek was seeking a Zecher. Right, which is why the battle over Amalek is a battle of memory. It's a battle over the Amalek is the quintessential suicide bomber. He knows that he's going to die. He knows he's not going to win this war. Nevertheless, the issue is not about whether I'm going to win the war. The issue is, can I leave my impact? Can I leave my zecher? Can I change the landscape and make the world different from me having been here? That is a very masculine kind of perspective. It tends to be the way men view the world a lot. Not just in terms of child rearing, but in terms of how they view the world, the ambition for conquering in the world at large, even conquering itself, is to the ambition for one of the greatest motivators for war itself is to impose your culture and to make your mark on the world around you. It can be a very violent kind of thing. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. So if you take this model and you go back to Yibum, you will find that Yibum is a tremendous sacrifice for both the male and the female, okay? It's a tremendous sacrifice for the female because it's a sacrifice to the male vision of child rearing. In other words, the female vision of child rearing is, it's not about me, it's not about leaving my mark in the world, it's about making sure the child becomes what the child's going to become. From the masculine standpoint, it's, if this child is mine, if he's going to be my mark in the world, then how can I let him be what it is that he, when he's not a perfect expression of what I need him to be? And I think that Yibum is very focused on Zecher. It's saying from the male perspective, if a man would die without having any children, would get married to have children, but then die without having children, from the male perspective, that would be very tragic. He has, that his line is going to be lost. There's no memory. There's no biological impact on the world. And it's a great act of loyalty for the woman to be able to put her life on hold, loyalty to her husband's vision, to allow his line to continue through this act of surrogate fatherhood. By the same token, it's a great sacrifice on the part of the brother who is marrying this woman, because if he's interested in making an impact on the world, it means his firstborn child is not really his. It's his brother's. In every way, spirit, shape, or form, it is the spiritual heir of his brother's, not his own. So it means devoting your life to conceiving a child and raising him, but he's not your child. Which is why Onan, by the way, in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, doesn't want to do it. Because he knows that the child is not going to be his. Okay, so it is a difficult thing for both parties. But somehow the story of Yibum always wends its way into the Davidic dynasty here and again and again in Ruth. And it's seen in this story and in the story of Ruth as a great sacrifice. Anyway, so Yibum is one of the background ideas for this story. Okay, getting back to Yehuda and Tamar itself. So that's the background for Yehuda and Tamar. Plunging right into Yehuda and Tamar, it seems to me that the great textual question of this story is the following. What is this story doing here? It completely interrupts the story of Joseph and his brothers. So now, I don't think the correct answer to that, by the way, is, oh, it's doing here because it's telling us about the Davidic dynasty. Well, that might be true also. That's not what it's doing here. I mean, that's going to happen later. The question is, Genesis on its own terms has to have an answer for what it's doing here. So the question is, if you read through the story of Joseph, you'll find that the last half of the book of Genesis is entirely devoted to the story of Joseph, with one exception, chapter 38, which begins this whole digression and gets into these details of Yehuda and his relationship to Tamar. When we're done with that, we come right back to Joseph in chapter 39. Meanwhile, Joseph was sold into slavery. As you begin to look at Yehuda and Tamar, I think this is the question you have. What is this? How does this story relate to the story of Joseph and his brothers? So what I'd like you to do, if I can, is I want to do the following. I'm going to give you... Well, I was going to give you some time to look over the story, but I'm not, because then I wouldn't have enough time to say anything. So what I'm going to do is summarize this story for you. And as I summarize for the story for you, and you can read this on your own terms over the next week. You'll have 2 weeks until we meet again. I'm going to summarize the story, and I want you to keep in mind the following question, which is, how is chapter 38, the story of Yehuda and Tamar, related to the story of Joseph? You will find, as you read the story, that it's not as unrelated as it might seem. That the themes which appear in the story of Joseph actually reappear in this digression. And that there are many themes which bind together the two stories. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to read through these stories. And I want you to keep your eye out for anything in one story that reminds you of the other story. Then we're going to add it up and see how it is that the two stories are sort of related to one another. So I'm going to be reading now from the end of chapter 37, going through 38. Okay? We're going to be reading from chapter 37, verse 22. The background of the story is the following. Chapter 37 opens with the story of Joseph and his brother. We are told in the beginning of the story that Joseph is 17 years old. And Joseph seems at first glance to be a corrosive force in the family. He is bringing bad tidings about his brothers back to his father. He is sort of making fun of some of the children in the family. And he is also the favorite of his father. And his father decides to make him a coat of many colors just to show him how much of a favorite he really is. Now, the brothers see all of this, and they decide that they hate him. And they can't live in peace with him. Joseph has these dreams of grandeur, and it makes the brothers hate him even more. Finally, one day, Joseph is sent out on a little mission to go see how his brothers are doing. And his brothers see him coming, and they decide the time is ripe to kill him. They say, here comes the dreamer. Let's come and kill him, verse 20, and we'll throw him in one of the pits, the Amarnu Chayara Achalasu, and we will say that a terrible beast has eaten him, and we will see what will be with his plan. So the original plan of the brothers, which goes through some evolution, the original plan of the brothers is we will kill him and we will say that it was the work of a wild beast. Now, we will see the plan goes through evolution where they decide they're not going to kill him. They're going to sell him instead. So that part of the plan falls away. But what about the part about a wild beast eating him? Does that fall away?
No.
So you say no. I say actually it has, even though it doesn't seem like it falls away. Because do they in fact say to Yaakov that a wild beast has eaten him?
No, they don't actually say it.
No, they don't actually say it. What do? They present Jacob with a bloody coat, and what do they say? They do not say, look at what the wild beast did. What do they instead say? They said, look at this coat. We found this. You recognize this coat? They fail to mention that it's all bloody, right? But it says, hey, you know, walking by, we found this coat, you know? Do you recognize this coat? Then Jacob responds and says, yes, I recognize the coat. It is my son's coat. And what's Jacob's response? These exact same words, Chaya ra'a achalasu, a terrible animal has eaten him. So what's happened is that this part of the plan sort of has fallen away too, yes and no. In other words, it all comes to the same thing, but they don't say it. The original plan was that we will say that a wild beast ate him. The plan evolves into a point where they're not going to kill him, and they also just present the coat, and Jacob comes to his own conclusions about a wild beast eating him. Now, I am not implying, Searle, that they have less moral culpability because of this, okay? However, what I am saying is just the fact of the matter that the plan has changed, okay? Now, at this point, you may shake your head and say there is no significance to this change. Maybe so. But let's be the judge of that in the long scope of the story and see, because I do think there's some significance to this change. Yes.
They did speak the words into the universe. The words.
Yes, and that's what it sounds like. They spoke the words into the universe, and it came back to haunt them because this is indeed what the Father... And by the way, this is what they expect the Father to come to. In other words, they expect the Father, of course, to come to this conclusion, but it's sort of insidious, right? Because what they're doing is they're allowing Jacob to dig his own grave. It's when your children say to you, well, I didn't lie, you know, I just put the facts out there in a way that made you come to your own conclusion. I didn't say that I didn't take the cookie. I just, you know, so what happened, it's sort of insidious in a way, because it almost would have been better, one could argue from a moral standpoint, to just outright deceive him. But here what happens is that Jacob, and they seem all innocent, we just found this, and Jacob comes to his own conclusion, and in the end, Jacob is the one who deceives himself, really, because it's only Jacob who says that he's dead. And then Jacob comes to believe that he's dead, even more than them deceiving him outright. So I'm, again, not making a judgment here about moral culpability, I'm just making a statement of fact. Okay, moving on. So plan number one is, let's kill him, let's throw him in a pit, let's say that a wild beast ate him. Then Reuven comes in. And Reuven says, no, nobody's killing anybody. And Reuven says, Al tishbuchu dam, let's not kill him. Let's throw him into this pit, the Yad Al tishlechu bo, and we are not going to kill him. And what Reuven said, or appears to be saying at this point to the brothers, is the following. What he is saying to the brothers and what his intent is different. What he is saying to the brothers is, Al tishbuchu dam, do not physically spill his blood, let's throw him into the pit, and let our hand not be upon him. Liad al tishlubo, and let's not send our hand upon him. Lama'an hatzilot al miyadam, in order to save him from his brothers, la shivo al aviv, to bring him back to his father. So here's Reuven's plan. If you think about it, is Reuven acting as a leader here or not? Because one can make the argument that the great test of leadership amongst the brothers is how do you deal with this crisis? I mean, how are you going to deal with Joseph? So we have Reuven, who, by the way, is the oldest brother, who would be looked to as the leader of the brothers. Now, does he act as a leader in this situation? Yes and no. In other words, yes to the extent that he takes it upon himself to do something about a situation which is going horribly wrong, but no in the sense that he doesn't feel that he has enough clout to be able to just stand up and say, this is wrong. In other words, he clearly believes this is wrong, but instead of saying, this is wrong, we can't do this, I take, you know, let the chips fall where they may, but I'm going to stand up and say, we can't do this, he doesn't do that. Instead, what he does is he devises an end run around these people. The end run is that let's kill him, but let's not physically kill him, let's let him starve to death in the pit. But by allowing him to be in the pit, it gives him a chance to come back later at night and return him to the brother. So what this is instead of asserting his forceful leadership of the people, he is finding another way around. But he doesn't see himself as able to stem the tide. Okay? Then what happens is you have the next possible plan. Everyone sits down, and who comes along but the Ishmaelites, and Judah then speaks up. And Judah then makes an argument, which you could argue, and I think one could effectively argue, that he is acting more like a leader than Reuven. Now, he's not as righteous as Reuven, but he is more like a leader than Reuven, which might be why Judah emerges from this story as the leader, albeit a flawed leader. But what he says is the following words. Judah then says to his brothers, "Ma betza kinaro getachinu v'chisinu etamo? What do we gain by killing our brother and spilling his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, v'yadenu al tibo, and we won't hurt him at all. Ki achinu b'sareinu hu, because after all, he is our brother, v'yishmu echav, and the brothers listen to him." You have to listen closely to what's happening over here. What Yehuda says are words that will live in infamy. These are words which Yehuda will pay for very dearly throughout the course of his life. They're flawed words. But they're also the words of a leader. Because what he does is he directly stands up to up to this group of people who are looking to kill someone, and he gets them to change their mind about what they're going to do. He changes the plan. Whereas Reuven did not succeed in materially changing the plan, because there's really no difference if you kill somebody or if you let him starve to death in a pit. Arguably, it's worse to let him starve to death in the pit. There is a difference if you kill somebody or if you sell him as a slave. And that is what Judah is arguing. Judah is saying, "Mabetza, let's not kill him. And what do we gain by killing him?" He appeals to their baser nature. He says, "Let's sell him into slavery." And then he says those key words, "Ki achinu b'sareinu hu," because after all, he is our brother. What does he mean when he says those words, "Because after all, he is our brother"? What's he throwing those words in for? What does he mean to say? He is making an argument here. He is making a moral argument here. His moral argument is, he says, you can't kill your brother. We may hate him, but he is our brother. So we're not going to go and kill him. And then listen to what the brothers do. What's the brother's response?
Okay.
The brother's response is, okay, expressed by which words? Vayishmu echav. And the brothers listened. Now, what does it mean, the brothers listened? So even in English, the word listened can mean two things. Listen can mean that I physically heard what you said. It can mean that I understand what you said, or it can mean that I accept what you said. Okay? Three levels of depth, really. Here, what does it really mean? It really means the third level, right? Which is that they accepted what they said. Now, this was a group of people that were looking to kill this person out of hatred for him. And now what they're doing is they defer their judgment. They accept what he said. You know, you're right. We really shouldn't kill him. Let's sell him. Vayishmu echo. And they listened. They listened in the sense of accepting. This is how Rashi understands it. Vayishmu echo. That they listened in the sense of accepting to what he said. And thus, Yehuda has acted like a leader here. However, he has acted as a very flawed leader. Because his very act of leadership itself points to its flaw, which is the very act of greatness that he has here to stand up for the moral principle and say, he is our brother, and it is wrong to kill your brother. Judah's absolutely right about that. But now let's take that to its logical conclusion. If he is your brother, and it's wrong to kill your brother, what should you do to this person? It's also wrong to sell him into slavery, right? So you have, together with the genesis of Judah's kingship, so to speak, you also have the great flaw in Judah's kingship, which is the inability to take this great recognition that he's made, this moment of reasoning, and to carry it through to its logical conclusion, which is, you know what? Brothers don't sell other brothers as slaves either. Nevertheless, Judah does not do that. Why does he not do that? Well, what is the failure of leadership that he has here? You could argue about that, but we'll come back to that, but this is a failure. He should have understood that you don't do this to your brother. He doesn't. Okay, what happens next? They sell Joseph into slavery, and Reuven, meanwhile, comes back to the pit, and now we have Reuven, who ironically is in a very different position than Yehuda. Because even though Yehuda has made the argument and stood up as a leader, but is a flawed leader, Reuven, from a moral angle, is on much better ground than Yehuda, but he's not acted as a leader. And now he's coming back, and he sees that fate has taken the chance away from him to do what he wanted to do. He sees that Yosef is no longer in the pit, and he feels terribly, and he rips his clothes in mourning. Right, his chance to bring him back to his father has been lost. Okay. The brothers then take Joseph's coat, they slaughter a goat, they dip the coat in the blood, and they send it back to the father, and they say those famous words, Zot matzanu, this we have found, Haker na, recognize please, Haktonat bincha hi imlo, if it is indeed the cloak of your son or not. Vayakira. And Jacob recognized it, and comes to his own conclusion and says, Knonet b'ni, it is the cloak of my son. Chayora'a chalasu, and a terrible animal has eaten him. Tarof toraf Yosef. Yosef has been torn apart alive. Vayikra Yaakov simlosav, and he tears his clothes. Vayasem sak b'masnav, and he puts sackcloth on him. Vaytabal b'no yamim ha'abim, and he mourns for his son many days. Okay? And then everyone gets up, trying all of his children to comfort him. But he refrains from being comforted, does not allow himself to be comforted, because he says, "Ki ered al bni avel sha'ola, I will go down to my grave, or to the grave, as an avel for my son, as a mourner for my son." And his father cries for him. And meanwhile, Joseph was sold into slavery. Now, what's interesting here also is Yaakov's reaction here. How would you characterize his reaction? In other words, put yourself in the brother's shoes. What would you have expected as a brother? In other words, when you threw Joseph in a pit, what were you hoping? You would hope that dad would get over this eventually, right? In other words, yeah, he loves Joseph, right? But he really loves us, right? And that's a passing trend. Can you imagine the horror of the brothers seeing that dad is not getting over this? The dad is not getting over it a year later. He's not getting over it 5 years later. That he's saying that he's going down to his grave as a mourner. And if you think about it, that probably was not something that they had bet on. Especially since, if you think about it, it's a very strange thing. It doesn't actually make a lot of sense. If you think about about the way of the world, what happens when someone dies? Is it really true that people go down mourning into their grave the death of people? Generally not. The Jewish structure for mourning is 11 months, and then you go on with your life. And there's a point that you can go on with your life. What, by the way, allows you to go on with your life? What allows you to go on with your life? The truth is that if you think about it, it doesn't even make sense that you should be able to go on with your life, especially if someone you lost was very dear for you, right? Because what changed? I mean, I lost it's a month afterwards, and I feel this aching, terrible hole in my life, and I think, how could I possibly go on? Now a year has passed, 2 years have passed, 10 years have passed, and yet I go on. Now, from a rational standpoint, you could argue nothing's changed. The same hole that was in your life, you can't replace this person. That hole is still in your life. What has changed? The sad, brutal fact is that nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is time. Right? And as the old adage goes, time heals all wounds. There's something very brutal about that, because time in that sense doesn't change anything. It's a fickle trick of memory, that I can't remember somebody in the vividness with which he was originally there. It's almost like you would think a betrayal of the memory of the deceased for that to be so, but it's the way human nature works, and it's what allows us to go on. Right? The gift of forgetting the intensity of that ache is what allows us to go on even when the ache is really there. Rashi comments upon the fact that what Yaakov is doing is illogical. That Yaakov says, what he says is not just hyperbole at the moment of death, because it's actually true. Yaakov does go down to his grave mourning Joseph. For years, he's always mourning Joseph. He's right. How come Yaakov knows that he's right? What Rashi says is a fascinating thing. He says what Yaakov intuited subconsciously is that the reason why you can go on in life is because you are able to forget. However, Rashi says, quoting a medrash, that hames mishtakach min alev, that someone who is dead can be forgotten from the heart, but not someone who's not really dead. The gift of forgetfulness that God gives in the world only applies to someone who's really dead. someone who you think is dead but is not really dead, you can't forget the same way. Right? God only gives the gift of forgetfulness if someone is truly dead to allow you to go on. At that moment, Yaakov, even though he didn't know it consciously and couldn't figure out why, but he intuited that he would never be able to get over this death. Why? Yosef was not, in fact, dead. So there was something about him that knew that he would not be able to forget. So what happens is that the cruel joke that is played upon Yaakov is that what the brothers badly miscalculated the situation. When the brothers get up to try to be Menachem him, to comfort him, it's not an act of hypocrisy. They think they can really comfort him. Indeed, maybe in their own mind, they might have thought that the fact that Yosef, that they know that Yosef isn't really dead, means that it's not such a terrible crime, and Dad will get over it, and Yosef will be fine, and we can all go on as a happy family. But in fact, the tables have been turned around in a wicked kind of way, that what the brothers thought would make things easier has in fact made things even worse than real death. Because in real death you can go on, but here Yaakov cannot go on. He is stuck in life, and the brothers are stuck with the realization that they can't get themselves out of it. Right? And then we get to the story of Yehuda and Tamar. All of a sudden, at this nadir in the history of the family, we go off, we completely leave behind the story of Yehuda and of Jacob, and we go into the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Yeah?
Isn't the a crueler thing for the brothers as a lesson is that the reason they wanted to get rid of Joseph is because they felt diminished by every aspect of his relationship with his father and his being.
And now nothing was solved.
And there was nothing.
That's right. In other words, the reason why they did all of this was, again, to get rid of that favored son and to try to restore some balance into the relationship. I'm going to tell you one thing that I really wasn't planning on telling you tonight. I was planning on saving this for a couple of weeks, but I'm going to tell it to you now in risks of ruining all my punchlines, right? Which I hate to do, right? But I'm going to do it anyway because you mentioned this, which is that there's a fascinating thing that if you look in Deuteronomy, in Parshat Ki Tetzeh, you will find words that sort of burn to the core with memories of this story. I'll read you the words. What does this story remind you of? 21 and 15 in Deuteronomy. Listen to these words. Torah says, "Ki tiyena l'ish shei nashim." When a man has two wives, because polygamy was permitted at the time, "Achat ahuva v'achat snua," one of whom he loves very much, "v'achat snua," and the other that he's not so crazy about. "V'yaldu lo banim ahuva v'snua." And both of these wives give birth to children to him. Ha'uva vasnua, the loved wife, vasnua, and the relatively speaking hated wife. V'haya ha-ben ha-bechor lasnia. And it turns out that the oldest son is the son of the snia, the son of the hated wife. By the way, in context, what's happened right before this is the story of Eshet Yifat Tower, the story of a man who in battle sees a captive woman from the enemy, takes her as his wife, right, is attracted to her beauty, and the Torah immediately follows with this story as if to tell you that the great danger in that story is that what will happen? He will take this woman attracted to her beauty, but then decide that she's not really from the same socioeconomic place in the ladder, right, so he's going to take his second wife. But his first wife is this woman that he found on the battlefield. She's going to have his oldest son. This is his wife. How is he going to deal with this situation when he feels that she wasn't really my wife? She was beautiful. I took her. Not really my wife, right? This is always the issue which the Torah is concerned about. We go back to the Amma Ivriya, the story of the maidservant. It's exactly the same issue which the Torah is worried about, right? Which is that in giving, going back to what we talked about a year ago with the Jewish maidservant, in giving a master the right to marry the Jewish maidservant, there's all sorts of good reasons for it. It allows for mixing between the classes. It's a Jewish welfare system. Girls from poor homes can come and marry into the nobility. But the danger always to be feared is that the master will marry this girl because she's prettier, because she's nice, because he's out of compassion, and she will be, but he'll say, "She's not really my wife. I'll marry someone else. She's really my wife." And then you have this rivalry in the system. And the Torah says that he explicitly can't do that, that he has to honor her completely as his wife, and he can't diminish her rights at all. He has to see her as entirely as an equal, or the entire relationship is illegitimate. We have echoes of that over here. Kitiena liishte nashim, when a man has two wives, one of whom that he loves and one of whom that he doesn't love, but the oldest child comes from this wife that he's not as crazy about. What does he do? V'haya biyom hanchilo et banav. And it will happen On the day that he causes his children to inherit, that he disperses his property to his children, es asher yila, that which he has to him, lo yuchal levaker et ben ahuva al pnei benas nua b'chor, he cannot make the loved child, the younger child, into his b'chor, into his firstborn, ki ata b'chor ben usnua yakir. Rather, he needs to recognize the difficult fact of the matter, that it is the child of the hated, of the relatively hated wife, that he must recognize as in fact the b'chor, the firstborn, latet lo pishnayim b'chol asher yimatzei lo, to give him a twofold portion in everything that belongs to him, ki hu reshit ono, because he is indeed the first of his strength, the firstborn, lo mishbat ha-b'chora, to him belongs the right of the firstborn. Now as you read this story, you'll find that there's a lot of coded terminology in this story, and it's meaning to hark us back to another story. What does this remind you of? What particular person does this remind you of? Ki tiyena li'ish shtei nashim. When a man has two wives, ha'ochat ahuva v'achat tznua, one whom he loves, the other that he doesn't love quite as much. Who is this? This is Jacob with Rachel and Leah. How do you know that it's Jacob and Rachel and Leah? It's not just that it feels like Jacob and Rachel and Leah. You know that this is Jacob and Rachel and Leah. How do you know? Because if you look at the words which the Torah uses to characterize Leah, you'll find that Leah is described as a snua, as a wife that is hated. That Leah says about herself that God saw that I was snua, that I was hated, and therefore he allowed me to have children. The Torah only once uses that terminology about a woman being hated in the eyes of her husband, and the only woman it says it about is Leah. Okay? So here, the Torah once again invokes that rare terminology. It says when you have a woman that's hated, two wives, one of whom that is hated, who is this? This is modeled after the story of Jacob and Rachel and Leah. And if you looked at it, the same thing happened, right? Who got married first? Leah. But then he decided that she wasn't my real wife. So he needed to marry Rachel, which was his love of his life that he had to marry. He worked 7 more years to be able to marry her. But now you're stuck, because now I have two wives, but I relate to them differently. And now I'm stuck in the next generation, because the same rivalry which exists in the first generation is now going to exist in the second generation. So what do you have? So now I have children. But my oldest children come from Leah, from the oldest. So what do I do? And now what does this remind you of? The day will come that you will decide where your possessions go. You cannot take the child that is younger, the child of the love of your life, and set him up as the firstborn. What does this remind you of?
It's Joseph.
What did Joseph get? The coat of many colors. Why? Who is Joseph? What was so special about Joseph? He's the first child from Rachel. He's the Bechor from Rachel. What is he saying? He's saying, this is my real wife. Right? This child is the child of my... This is the real child. He is my Bechor. And therefore, I give him the coat of many colors to say that he is the one that it's really all about. The Torah says, looking back at that, you cannot do that. Rather, what do you need to do instead? Ki et ha-Bechor ben usnua yakir latet lo pishnayim b'chol asher yimatzei lo. Rather, what you must do is you must recognize the truth of the matter that the child who is the child of the hated wife, he is the Bechor. You must give him a double portion, b'chol asher yimatzei lo, with everything that it belongs to you, ki hu reshit ono. Reshit ono is a very specific phrase. Reshit ono literally means he is the first of your strength. In other words, the idea of a firstborn is that a man's strength, his very first child, comes from this. Reshit ono is the kind of idiomatic phrase, the first of his strength that we talk about a firstborn with. Now, going back to the story of Joseph and his brothers, what does this remind you of? Reshit ono, where do you have these words? Well, I'll give you a hint. Yeah, do you know where?
Well, in the bracha, but you expect...
Yes, in the bracha. That's right, and finally he gets it. But the first time you have it is even before. It's with Binyamin. Okay? With Binyamin, who is the second child from Rachel. Rachel has two children. Child number one, Joseph. Child number two, Binyamin. Anyone know how Binyamin got his name? Binyamin got his name through in tragic circumstances. Benjamin was not originally known as Benjamin. It's not what his mother named him. His mother named him something else. Rachel died in childbirth, in giving birth to Benjamin. And she did not name him Benjamin. She named him Ben-Oni. Ben-Oni means the child of my suffering. Okay? Aleph, Vav, Nun, Yud can mean two things. It can either mean strength, my strength, or it can mean my suffering. She takes it to, she uses it in the sense of, this is the child of my suffering. She was dying, and she named the child Ben Oni, the child of my suffering. Yaakov turns around and names this child Binyamin instead of Ben Oni. Binyamin means the son of my right hand. Okay? My right hand is my strength. Why is he naming this child the son of my right hand? What does it have to do with Ben Oni, what she named the child? The answer is that he's using the word Oni in the other sense of the word. He's taking what she said, but using it in its opposite meaning. Right? She said, this is the child of my suffering. But from his perspective, what he saw is, no, you're my wife. You're my real wife. This is the child of my strength. It's almost like this is another firstborn child for me. Now I've been another favorite child. And yes, you called him Ben Oni, the child you were suffering. But I raised this up and I call him Binyamin. Right? Yamin, synonymous with the other meaning for Oni, which is the son of my right hand, the son of my strength. This is how the Ksav Kabbalah, the great German exegete, right? The Ksav Kabbalah in the 19th century, contemporary with Hirsch, reads the phrase and sees the connection between Binyamin and Ben Oni. So what's happening over here? The Torah again is relating to this. Kihu reshito no. No. Who is the first of your strength? The first of your strength is not the sons with the other wife. It's really the son that was biologically firstborn. You have to come to grips with the reality that you married this woman, and that's life. That is the way things are. And now look at this. Where do we hear these words? It says, Ki et habachor ben asnua yakir latet lo pishnayim b'chol asher yimatzei lo. And it's strange, these words. You must recognize, Ki et habachor ben asnua yakir, you must recognize him as firstborn, latet lo pishnayim, to give him b'chol asher yimatzei lo, everything that is found to him. Now these words are strange, because if I were the one writing this part of the Torah, I would have found these two verbs forced. Okay, I would say you need to make the real firstborn son the real firstborn son. The Torah stretches it to say no. Ki'atachor ben asnua yakir. You have to recognize the bechor ben asnua. The recognize is used as a verb here, which is similar to, you have to make him into the firstborn. How do you make him into the firstborn? You recognize, but it doesn't mean just recognize. It's a very active kind of recognition. It's not just recognize the facts of the matter. It's that it's recognition in the sense of your recognition is you're crowning him as Bechor, but it's a forced way to use the word recognition. And again, when I talk about the state, I would say just give him double in your estate. No, to give him double in what is found to you. Why to give him double in what is found to you? B'chol asher yimatzei lo, in everything that is found to you. Because once again, the Torah is quoting from the story of Joseph and his brothers. And where is it quoting from? Where do we have the words hakara, yakir, recognition, together with metzia, with finding, in the story of Joseph and his brothers? That's what's all over the place. But the first, most primal place it is when the brothers present the bloody coat to their fathers. And listen to what they say. They say, Zot matzanu, this we have found. Hakerna, recognize, please. Haktonet bincha hiim lo, is it really your son's coat or not? What are they really saying? I think if you read Deuteronomy here is a commentary on what it is that they're really saying. What Deuteronomy is doing is it's taking the brothers' words, the brothers' mention of hakara, of recognition, together with their recognition of metzia, of finding, and using those two words and bring them out of this story into here and saying, you know what you've really got to do? When you have a child that you want to make firstborn, you can't do it. You have to recognize the reality that the other child is the firstborn and give him everything in terms of what is found to you. What does found to you mean? Found to you is a synonym for your estate. What does yakir, recognition, mean? Recognition is a synonym for coming to grips with the reality that your firstborn is really your firstborn. Now translate the meaning of those terms back into Genesis, and you'll see how Deuteronomy is commenting on Genesis. Listen to what the brothers say. They come to the father with a bloody coat. And what do they say? Zot matzanu. This we have found. Hakerna, recognize, please. Is it haktonet bincha hiim lo? Is it your son's coat or not? What are they saying? Zot matzanu. Translate from Deuteronomy. This we have found. What is this? This is the estate. This is it. This is the double portion. This is your stuff. that you give to the one who's the firstborn. We found it, right? And now, Hakerna, recognize. What do you mean recognize? Recognize who the real firstborn is. It's not him. He doesn't deserve it. It's us. You can't go favoring him. Look at what you're doing. You're tearing our family apart. You can't give your estate to him. Haktonet bin chahim lo. Is it really your son's cloak or not? Has a double meaning. It's not just, did it belong to him? It's, does it really belong to him? It doesn't belong to him. This belongs to us. So the brothers really saw that this was how they were going to get rid of the menace, right? That dad has made a terrible mistake. And the Torah agrees, by the way, that dad has made a terrible mistake, because Deuteronomy is modeled after avoiding this mistake. It's saying that if you want to know what tore apart the family, Jacob can't escape responsibility for what tears apart the family. What tore apart the family is his attempt to make Joseph the firstborn brother and to love him more in that situation. And look what it led to, and never again, you can't do that. When you have two wives, you always have to recognize the truth of the matter. Nevertheless, the brothers are attempting to deal with this, but it's their attempt to deal with it which destroys things even more. Right? Because what they do is that they try to solve it in an impossible way, and they dig the hole deeper, seeking to uproot the love of their father. What they do is they do nothing but dig Jacob deeper into focusing on Yosef as being the only child that he could possibly love, and now he's stuck with this child that he loves that he can't go on with, right? Because if Joseph was really dead, or if he was still alive, so it would be a dynamic situation. But now he's dead, and when he's dead, then you lock yourself in that romance of that particular time. It's static. It never changes. It's like any good love story is never a dynamic love story. It's always the remembrance of some static situation because tragedy intervened, right? Right? Lahavdil elef havdalas, right? To make a great distinction between the two, Casablanca, for example, right? What happens? It's a great love story because they could never be together again, so you could always imagine what might have been. Lahavdil elef havdalas, right? But our great love song in the Torah is Shir HaShirim, right? But Shir HaShirim has the same thing. What happens is the man longs for a time when his beloved was there, but his beloved, he's not there with her anymore. So he's mourning a static situation, right? Strangely, we have very few great romantic love stories of a dynamic situation where two people are still together and constantly in love, because then it's dynamic and the mystique is gone. The challenge is to find a way to preserve that mystique. But the easiest way to preserve that mystique, right, is death. Because death, so now I can just take something at its most shining moment and always remember and pine for what might have been. So what you have with Yosef is that the mystique of Yosef stays, right? The irony is that if Yosef could have been allowed to live, right, then maybe the dynamics of the situation could have worked for Yaakov to get over. But now, ironically, in their attempt to uproot the situation, all they've done is solidified it, that the moment when Yaakov loved Yosef the most is now going to be frozen in time, and now Yosef becomes the hero that Yaakov will never again will never be able to get over. And therefore, the situation is stuck. It is at this point in the situation that we enter into a digression, the story of Yehuda and Tamar. But I think we will now be able to see that this digression is not a digression at all. Everything we've said now about this story, as we read the story of Yehuda and Tamar, you will see that it's not a digression. That what was happening in the story of Yaakov and his brothers is happening again in a different venue in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. That it's one of the most exquisite pictures of Mida Keneged Mida, which you can find, of God somehow working the levers of history so things work out in such a consummately elegant way that a person who brings great suffering upon someone ends up literally being in exactly the same shoes. If you ask yourself, what shoes is Yehuda in this story? Where does Yehuda find himself in the story? You will be forced inescapably into the fact that he finds himself in exactly the same shoes as Yaakov that left in the last story. And thus begins the story of Yehuda and Tamar. So we come back next week. Two weeks. So your challenge is to look at the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and ask yourself, what resonates in the story of Yehuda and Tamar from the story of Yosef and his brothers? How do the stories fit together? And then we'll be in a position to be able to put it all together. So I'll see you next week, 2 weeks from now, and we'll continue then. This is the end of tape 3. The series continues at this point on tape 4.